Now, the new 940 Montreal presents The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman.
We're coming to you earlier today, Montreal, because one-third of humanity is going to be watching a soccer game. And that may all be well and good. Entertainment and diversion has its place. But as Edward Murrow warned 40 years ago, if media becomes only that, only a vessel for media and diversion, we will have failed in our task and we will have failed the people. So I think it's important for these 2 hours leading up to the pregame show that we're going to have here to look at the world and to remember another time when the world looked at Berlin. When a young American president came to Berlin and he talked about the experiment in liberty that we are still trying to perfect today. And at that time, too, many people, as in our world today, felt alienated, disconnected, powerless to do anything. And he said to them, don't give up. Everybody thought problems were insolvable. Everybody thought Stalingrad was indefensible. And Bastogne for that matter. And it was a terrible time in world history. Berlin was under siege. And that young president, John Kennedy, in that speech said, anyone who thinks that our experiments and our defense of liberty is failing, lass sie nach Berlin kommen. Let them come to Berlin. Not to watch a soccer game, but to watch a proud people fighting for their freedom, involved in mankind's transcendent yearning for redemptive change. And my friends, we live in a world of instant communication and instant destruction, where each man's suffering diminishes us. We have for too long in this country surrendered our engagement in world affairs, surrendered our engagement in the reduction of suffering, and succumbed to inappropriate consumerism, inelegant self-absorption, and absolutely unearned smug self-satisfaction based on nothing. We now have a prime minister who's trying to change that, who perhaps for the first time since Laurier is giving us an international vision, who's telling us that we can no longer be a country that takes cheap resources and cheap labor from the third world, and that we have a responsibility, if we do that, to be involved in giving hope to those people living under oppression. We are no longer a country, to use his words, that cuts and runs. We are a country that had the courage to call for the arrest of Saeed Mortazavi, the Iranian prosecutor who killed Montreal photojournalist Zahir Shorzami. We have a new vision that says we need a bigger military to be involved in the world, to understand the fierce urgency of now, because this is our time. And maybe when Laurier said that the 20th century will belong to Canada, he was a century early. If we remember that other time in Berlin. So today we're going to take a look at the world. And we've done a couple of shows last week on the Middle East. We're going to leave that aside for the moment, because there are many things happening to many people in many parts of this world, where good and innocent people are put upon by evil people. Evil people hiding behind pretenses of diplomatic hypocrisy and false piety. And for the next 2 hours, we're going to take a trip around this small global village, this little blue ball hanging in the universe, and we're going to go from Mexico City to China to North Korea, and we're going to examine our own sense of purpose and where we're going past merely celebrating our diversions and our entertainment. We'll be right back with our first guest after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. You're listening. listening to the new 940 Montreal. Now, back to the last angry man, Beryl Wiseman. Call Beryl at 790-0006.
One of the world's largest democracies had a very important election this past week. It was a hotly contested election. It is still going on. It'll probably be taken to the courts. The winner, or the apparent winner, could have won by less than 1% of the vote. The country we're talking about, of course, is Mexico. Our first guest wrote in Barricades, which is the journal of the Institute for Public Affairs, something very prescient some 4 months ago. He said that the next government in Mexico has to put aside the schizophrenia that has characterized the political class and its relationships with the United States. And we have to North Americanize, and by North Americanizing our political culture, it does not mean the nullification of our past or of our sovereignty or of what we are as Latino Americans. The two visions of the two leading candidates are very different. Felipe Calderon, who is the apparent winner, the successor to current President Vicente Fox, the National Action Party, represents a more pro-business status quo approach. His populist opponent, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, of the Democratic Revolutionary Party, was former mayor of Mexico City, beloved by millions. There was an attempt to smear him, and he may be taking the results of this election to what's called the Federal Election Institute in Mexico, which was set up 6 years ago in what was generally considered to be the first free election, if I could use that expression, in Mexico in quite some time. To discuss these issues in this election is vital to Canada and vital to North America. It's vital to NAFTA. It's vital to European integration. It's vital to oil, with Mexico having great reserves. Is Ambassador Andre Rosenthal. Ambassador Rosenthal is president of the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations, singularly unique background in diplomatic affairs, having served as his country's representative in England, France, the United Nations, and we're very pleased and proud to have him with us this morning. Ambassador Rosenthal, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Beryl. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Ambassador, I guess we should first begin with the Mexican electoral system. David Frum, who I know you've met, referred to the system pre-the 2000 elections as defective and broken. Has the system worked this time around?
The system has worked, and it has worked extraordinarily well in terms of the actual process leading up to and including the day of the election. 300 electoral districts, 130,000 polling stations, the number of incidents or problems reported was minimal. 600 and some electoral observers from Europe, from Canada, from the United States, from Latin America were present. And I think that there is a consensus in Mexico, and that's where it's most important, of course, that this election was conducted in a very exemplary way.
Now, I know your colleague, not your colleague, but certainly a professional acquaintance, Robert Pastor, from the Washington Bay Center for Democracy and Election Management, has said that these elections were free and fair, and they developed tremendously in the past 10 years, the electoral process, and they're among the very best in the world. Mr. Obrador, on the other hand, just yesterday played a tape that apparently suggests a certain degree of collusion, if I can use that word, between what was called the Institutional Revolutionary Party that ruled Mexico for 70 years and Mr. Calderon's ruling PAN coalition. How far is this going to play out, and how far is Mr. Obrador going to take this? He had a rally of some 280,000 people yesterday, I believe.
Yeah, difficult to say, Beryl, how long and how far he wants to take it. He has a record over the whole of the campaign, and also when he was mayor of Mexico City, of basically presuming that there are a series of plots against him, that he is a victim of collusion by others. He has accused the Fox administration of having thrown the election to the PAN candidate. But all of these are, as far as we can tell, and I think that this is a general consensus both within and without Mexico, sort of a drowning man's kick, trying to find ways to reverse the results of the election. It's true that the results of the election were very close. It's true that out of 41 million people who voted, which is a 60% voting rate from the number of people who were eligible to vote, which
almost better than Canada's.
Not bad. Out of 41 million votes, Calderon won by 237,000. This is after a recount, by the way, because López Obrador insisted that the first time round he wanted to have every one of the electoral districts certified again.
That's correct, and the vote was Wednesday, I believe, the recount.
Exactly. This took place, and the results were exactly the same as the first time around, almost exactly the same.
Ambassador Roosevelt, please stay with us. We're just going to pay some bills, and we're going to come back and talk about the policies, not the politics of this election. Montreal will be right back.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. We're talking with a very special guest, Ambassador Andrew Rosenthal, Chair from the Mexican Council on Foreign Relations. Ambassador Rosenthal, you were saying before the break that these elections, even though won by Calderon and the ruling party by a small minority, there was a lot of oversight, it was properly done, and the Obrador's comments about fixing or rigging the votes and the tapes he supposedly played were a last man's gasp. How far is Obrador prepared to take this? Will it be the Federal Election Institute into September?
Well, we have a procedure, Beryl, which is very clearly set out in our electoral laws. The Federal Electoral Institute has concluded its work, and the next stage, which starts tomorrow, Monday, begins with the Federal Electoral Tribunal, which is a special branch of the judicial branch of government here in Mexico, that will begin to receive any complaints or any challenges to the results. The understanding and what López Obrador announced yesterday, and by the way, he's the only one of five political parties that competed in the election to allege that there had been any misconduct, that he is going to take a series of what he says are proofs that there was misconduct to the tribunal. And then the tribunal has a process that it goes through, which may last all the way up until the end of August. Isn't necessarily so, but it may last all the way up to the end of August, when they examine each one of these allegations and they make decisions. Their decisions are final, no appeal. It is a general consensus by most people, certainly myself, that the tribunal will confirm Calderon's victory and will confirm the fact that the election was conducted in an exemplary fashion.
So, last question on this part. You don't see this election as being a replay of 1988, when most observers felt that the revolutionary democratic candidate, Cárdenas, had the election stolen by Carlos Salinas of the IRP.
Not at all, Beryl. We didn't have the Federal Electoral Institute then. We didn't have the tribunal. We didn't have the observers. We didn't have all of the trappings of democracy that we have put up and established in the Mexican political system.
Now,
and I think that it's clear that what happened in 88 could not possibly happen now.
What are your hopes then for a Calderon administration, and what has President Fox not addressed, particularly in the issues that involve Canada, that America, North American integration. We've heard, of course, from both parties, certain disenchantments with NAFTA, and we've also heard certain hesitancies, of course, and probably rightly so, about this idea that was floated around 3 weeks ago in Washington about political integration of North America. This just was a float from the White House. What are the priorities going forward to avoid what you so eloquently stated as national schizophrenia?
Well, I think, first of all, I'd just point out very quickly, Beryl, that I think Calderon has to govern with a unity, a coalition type of government when he takes office on the 1st of December. He's going to have to be very inclusive by bringing in people and ideologies that are not necessarily the ones that he personally has espoused because of the split. I mean, after all, 200,000 votes in a 14 million vote election is a very large degree of polarization, and I think it's very important that he be inclusive.
On the other hand, we can remember that President Kennedy won by 110,000 votes, and President Bush lost the first election by 400,000 votes on a vote basis.
That's correct. But I think that in the case of Mexico, what sets us perhaps apart from those two examples is the fact that there was such a very clear difference between the approach of López Obrador and the approach of Calderón. And I think that the polarization that results from that requires Calderón to and he has said that he's going to do so, by the way, to govern in a somewhat different way than, say, Fox did. As far as the pending issues, I think that Fox unfortunately raised a great deal of expectations, many of which were unfulfilled. Some of which have to do with some of the structural reforms that the Mexican economy still requires, a fiscal reform, an energy reform, a labor reform. It's my hope that Calderón will be better able to get the consensus that he needs in Congress because he's going to govern with an opposition Congress. He doesn't have a majority in either of the two houses. And he's going to have to be, again, inclusive not only in bringing in the PRD and the PRI parties and some of their people, but also in terms of how he conciliates points of view in Mexico to be able to get the agenda that he wants to go forward. And his agenda is very much similar to and the continuation of the Fox agenda and the PAN party agenda, which has been on the table for the last 6 years.
Well, Ambassador Rosenthal, if Mr. Calderón has the good sense to turn to people like you, we may have some hope for confidence going forward. Ambassador Andrew Rosenthal, I thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Beryl. It's always a pleasure.
Take care. Montreal will be back after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call the Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Continuing our overview of the world on this World Cup soccer final day, we go from Mexico to China. In the 1970s, the Soviet Union, as a way of dealing with dissenters, political and otherwise, would put them into psychiatric hospitals. The logic, in a perverse Kafkaesque way, was almost unassailable. If you were a dissident against a tyrannical regime, ipso facto, you must be mad. Therefore, the state had a right to put you in a psychiatric hospital. Many of these victims came out broken, destroyed, and permanently damaged. All evidence today points to a new use of this horrendous state means of incarceration and personal destruction. But this time it's not only psychological, it's physical, and it's deadly. Evidence has been mounting over the past year that the Chinese government has not only been imprisoning followers of the Falun Gong movement, but doping them, drugging them, incarcerating them, killing them, and most of all, harvesting their organs and returning the bodies to their families, sewn up unless there were missing limbs. Now, we at the Institute got a report on this from one of our interns who was on her way to Cambodia to do human rights work in children's advocacy for an NGO called Likado. It was horrendous pictures, horrendous reports. And it finally got the attention of people who could bring this issue to a higher level. And our next guest is one of these people. André Malraux, the great French writer, once said that society can only be changed through the involvement of les citoyens engagés, engaged citizens, people who render life to account. David Mattis has had a remarkable national legal career. An outstanding human rights lawyer. He's been a member of the Canadian delegation to the UN General Assembly. He's been on the Task Force on Immigration Practices and Procedures. He's been on the Canadian delegation to the Stockholm International Forum on the Holocaust, the Canadian delegation to the UN Conference on the International Criminal Court, and since 1997, the director of the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development. David Mattis, together with former MP David Kilgore, have just concluded a study on China's treatment of the Falun Gong that ends with two sentences. The very horror makes us reel back in disbelief, but that disbelief does not mean that the allegations are untrue. And we'll be right back to talk to David Mattis right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
David Mattis from Toronto, thank you very much for taking the time today. I know you have a family engagement, and thank you for being with us. I think this is an important issue that people don't know enough about. It shouldn't be page 8, it should be page 1. Welcome.
Thank you.
David, what did you find out? How bad and how widespread is this practice? How many people have been affected?
Well, I mean, we do face a certain amount of difficulty just getting to the bottom of this because we're dealing with crimes where the victims are dead and their bodies cremated. The perpetrators are unlikely to confess. There are no bystanders. The scene, an operating room, is antiseptic after the crime is committed. So some obvious elements of proof that would exist in other cases are not present in this case. We pieced together a number of different pieces of evidence. One of the things we did is we had investigators make phone calls into various places in China just to make inquiries, pretending they were customers for organ transplants and asking if they had transplants available and what the sources were and whether they were Falun Gong and whether they were alive at the time.
And the calls would be made to state authorities?
Oh, yes, to the hospitals. That's right.
Remarkable.
And these, of course, the people that were being called were selling their wares and making big money from it. So and many of them were quite forthright. And we had these calls throughout China, and we actually produced in our report a map of all the different places we called where admissions were made in the telephone calls. And we've got the transcripts and the tapes and the phone numbers still. So all of this is independently verifiable. And
David, in all this, in all the investigations, we received a report at the Institute that actually showed pictures, and about a week after we received this report, and the pictures, we saw something on 60 Minutes about this, where hospitals were shown with furnaces in the back where the bodies were ostensibly thrown in, the bodies that weren't returned to the families were thrown into these ovens, and these huge smokestacks were spewing up black smoke. Did you get any evidence of that? Of the destruction of bodies after the organ harvesting?
Cremation is the standard. It's standard in China. It's quite common, and we know that there is, and the Chinese government admits that there is harvesting of organs from executed prisoners with cremation to follow. So the issue became not whether the harvesting of organs is happening, but whether it's happening to Falun Gong in particular.
And whether they're targeting Falun Gong to get them into the hospitals.
Exactly. Without any executions, without any sentence of death, without any court procedure. And that's what we found. Obviously, in a Canadian context, this is horrific. And if it were...
I would think in any context it's horrific.
Well, sure, but if it
you and I go back to the struggles of the Soviet Jury in the 70s, it was bad enough that they put them in the psychiatric hospitals.
But what I would say is that if somebody said this was happening in Canada, it would be very hard to believe, because we're nowhere near that here. But in China, they're very close to that by their own admission, because they are harvesting the organs of executed prisoners without their consent and then cremating the bodies. So to go to the next step, to do that against the Falun Gong, who are... Sorry, I have to put some money in the machine.
It's all right. David is running between meetings in Toronto for our listeners, and he's been good enough to take the time to have this discussion with us.
There we go. Okay, so anyhow... There's that thing we know. We did some calculation based on the number of transplants, and we tried to indicate the sources of transplants and what were otherwise identified sources. And basically, we were not able to identify, through other sources, 41,500 transplants in that six-year period between 2000 and 2005. So we estimated that these transplants came from Falun Gong.
Remarkable. For those listeners of who may not be aware, could you briefly describe what Falun Gong is, and why the Chinese government considers them such a threat?
It's basically it's an exercise group with a spiritual component. It's sort of like Tai Chi.
Tai Chi, right?
But it's got a spiritual component attached to it. And
why are the government so afraid of them?
Well, because they've got large numbers, and they're capable of mobilizing them.
How large in terms of numbers?
Well, before the crackdown, they were estimated 70 million.
Really?
Yeah, it was really huge. They were able to, when the crackdown started, they were able to mobilize a gathering at Tiananmen Square, which was the largest gathering since the democracy repression.
And we remember that one man standing in front of the tank at Tiananmen. If there was ever a visual representation of Emerson's quote about one man abiding by truth, resolute shall rally a majority, that was it. So 70 million abiding by truth.
Yes, well, and it just spooked the Chinese government. They viewed this as an ideological threat, because these people are certainly not communists. They believe in something else. And the government felt that this was a threat to their ideological hold on the people of China, and that's what led to the repression.
David, if you could stay with us for a few moments, we just have to pay some bills, and I want to ask you where we should all go as a country from here. Montreal will be right back with David Mattis.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
We're back, Montreal, and we're talking with one of Canada's leading human rights lawyers, David Mattis, who's just completed a remarkable study with David Kilgore on China's repression of the Falun Gong. David Kilgore was formerly Secretary of State for the Asia-Pacific region. Any of his contacts were of any help in seeking out information or redress or direction?
We did meet with the government of China, their embassy. David Kilgore met with the political counselor there, Mr. Sun. We'd originally requested a meeting in order to arrange for a possible visit there to pursue our investigation, but the Mr. Sun basically just wanted to meet with David Kilgore to deny the allegations, and so we weren't able to get into China. But, obviously he knows a number of people in the government of Canada, and we're hopeful. In fact, the government of Canada has said they would pursue this investigation themselves to look into it.
And that's very important. What can Canadians as individuals do? Naturally, they can contact the Chinese embassy. But more than that, we've had a change of direction, a toughness of direction in foreign affairs under this government, when this government can call for the arrest of Saeed Murtazavi, the Iranian prosecutor that allegedly beat Sarah Kazemi over the head with a shoe, causing her death as the observer at the Human Rights Council. What should Canada do? What message should they send to China?
Well, first,
and in what form?
I don't think we should be allowing people to go to China to get transplants, or allowing transplant surgeons to come to Canada for whatever reason, for courses or so on, or conferences, until this whole issue is cleared up. I think the government of Canada should, as they intended they would, look into it and form their own conclusions. And there's a lot that can be done without accepting or rejecting the allegations simply to improve protection to prevent these sorts of things happening in China, where China can improve its respect for human rights generally, and Canada should press for that.
Now, David, you were very involved in the late 70s and early 80s in everything from Jackson Vanik to Helsinki Final Act. Is there anything, any initiatives that Canada and like-minded nations should start enacting about even trade relations with a tyrannical regime?
Well, trade relations raises a difficult issue because it, what it involves is whole-scale cooperation, and it's kind of an indirect form of pressure. And what we're dealing with here is a contested allegation. I think what would be most helpful to start with is for Canada to decide itself whether these allegations are true, and if they decide they're true, stand behind them. And I think that the more people who are satisfied, make their own investigations and come to the conclusion that the allegations are true, as we did, the more pressure just that finding a fact would have in changing the situation.
Putting aside my admiration for your body of work over the years, do you really believe that the Canadian government can get better people than you and David Kilgore to make an investigation? What other investigation do they need?
Well, thanks for saying that. But even if they were just to adopt our own conclusions as their own, I think that would be helpful.
Certainly.
What's important is that they come to their own conclusions, whether their own through investigations or accepting our own.
Would it help, for example, if Canadians wrote to Deepak Oberoi, who's the Parliamentary Secretary for Asian Affairs?
Sure. I think any communication with the Government of Canada on this would be helpful.
There's a remarkable website of the China International Transplantation Network Assistance Center. Now, it lists prices for organs ranging from $30,000 for a cornea to $130,000 for a heart. Can this stuff not be shut down?
Well, in fact, that came out because there was an ex-wife of a surgeon, a transplant surgeon, who made these allegations in Washington, D.C., and after she made her statements, the China Transplant Center removed that price list from its website, but it's still accessible because it's archived, and we were able to get it through archiving.
Very good.
And I think what's more important is that the prohibition of charging, the advertising of charging is certainly reprehensible, but it's the charging itself that's the problem. And China has actually just enacted a legislation a few days ago that came into force July 1st that prohibits all this stuff, but of course it doesn't deal with what happened before, and China has a very sorry history of enacting laws that are not enforced.
Final question, David. Were you and David Kilgore given any threats, subtle or otherwise, in your investigation?
Definitely not. In fact, as I indicated to you, the Chinese embassy, when they met with us, they were hopeful to dissuade us. So their initial attitude was dissuasion. They have posted a response on the website since our report came out, which came out the same day as our report, which to me indicates they obviously didn't give much consideration to our report. And the response, I wouldn't say it's threatening, but it's insulting. It's an attack on us personally rather than an attempt to deal directly with the allegations.
Character assassination by innuendo. David Mattis, as long as we have citoyen engagé like yourself, then governments can do all they want. The people will get the truth. I thank you very much for taking the time out today on a busy Sunday.
Okay, thanks for inviting me.
Have a good rest of the day.
Thank you.
Montreal will be right back after this.
This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call the Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
So, Montreal, we're doing our own World Cup review of the world. We've gone from Mexico to China. Now we're going to North Korea. You've heard a lot of news in the past week. The Koreans test-fired 7 missiles that have the capability to carry nuclear warheads. Despite the fact that there are 6-party talks going on, question in everybody's mind is, Kim Jong-il just crazy, silly, or is he crazy like a fox? Is he doing it for himself? Is he doing it to tweak the nose of the Americans? Is he doing it as a client of China, with China reacting to the recent India-America nuclear agreement? And to go over these issues is someone with singular knowledge in this area, Colonel Peter Reynolds is former NATO Director of Public Affairs and has recently served a tour as a special advisor to the United Nations Office of Project Services overseeing the Iraqi elections. And Peter is hopefully not too jet-lagged because he's just flown in from London to Washington. Peter Reynolds, welcome. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure, Barrow. Good morning to you.
Oh, you sound brisk and bright and bushy-tailed.
Yeah, it's this jet lag. I woke up before 4 o'clock this morning.
There's no jet.
Give me another hour, and I'll be on my back.
No, so the jet lag's over. You sound terrific. So, Peter, what do we make of Kim Jong-il and his 20,000 movies, and he can't feed his people, but he's flying off missiles, and what's he doing this for?
Well, you have to say that the timing was pretty good.
July 4th.
Picking July 4th to send off his rocket. It's just a shame that after 46 seconds, it decided to call it quits. And it was the most advanced of the ones that we suspect he has. The rumor is that he does have a more upmarket model than that one that he set off, a Taepongdong X missile, which supposedly has even a slightly further range than the Taepongdong 1, which is allegedly capable of hitting Alaska.
But right now, Japan's kind of nervous.
And probably has every right to be, because on occasions, some of the short-range ones do cross over Japanese land and could land on them. And if they have the right warhead attached, could cause a certain amount of damage.
Now, you had a career looking at the motivations of various leaders, some sane, some not so sane. And right after we pay a bill, a short bill, I want to talk to you about what the hell is going through Kim Jong-il's mind. Montreal, we'll be right back with Colonel Peter Reynolds.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. You can email me at info@iapm.ca. And we're talking to Colonel Peter Reynolds, just flying in to Washington, or flown into Washington from London, about the potential threat from North Korea. So, Peter, why? What is with Kim Jong-il? I mean, we know some very strange things about him, his 20,000 movie collection, his kidnapping of the movie directors, his self-aggrandizement, his elevator shoes. Is this a pretense to make him look silly, or is he crazy like a fox? And what's behind his... saber-rattling?
Well, perhaps that's just what it is. I mean, I'm singularly ill-trained to actually analyze what this person is actually thinking about it. Well, we have to judge him by his actions, and his actions are, he's saying, hey, look, I'm still here, I haven't gone away. You know, the six-party talks may not be going the whole way or the way that he would wish to see them go. He may be feeling some pressure from China. He may be feeling some serious pressure from the United States and its allies, both Japan and South Korea. And even the Russians may not be working fully 100% behind him. And we do know he does have serious internal economic problems.
What does he think, that by firing off missiles, people in North Korea are going to forget the fact they can't feed their children?
Well, I doubt it, but he's just saying to the others, hey, I haven't gone away. And, you know, if you wish to help me in some way by helping to feed my people, that may be the way he's thinking. I personally think it's the wrong way of going about it.
How much of this is fueled by China? Is China using North Korea as a client state, sort of saying to the United States, okay, you guys signed a nuclear agreement with India. Well, we've had three wars with India, and we got North Korea as a client state, and just watch yourselves.
I see it in slightly more simplistic terms. I don't think this is being fueled by China, but, I mean, who am I to make that sort of speculation? What I do feel is that if he fires off the missiles and some of them land on Chinese territory, he's not going to have that many friends left in China and may find himself even more cold-shouldered, not just by the other parties involved in the six-party talks, or in the UN countries who are now trying to come to a resolution, and the U.S. envoy, Hill, is currently in Japan, having been to China already this week to try and get this resolution put forward to really sideline him. And I am of the opinion that perhaps we should go back to the Kissinger doctrine, which is, heck, you know, put him into a state of cold war, sideline him totally, and just wait for the country to implode. Why get seriously worked up about it and threaten them?
Just marginalize. Well, I presume the reason is because people still aren't sure, even at the highest levels, just what role is China playing. But I want to get back to a point you made that some of these missiles, if they work, could reach Alaska. Would that imply that Canada should take another look at joining North American Missile Defense?
I find that difficult to judge. Whether you like it or not, you're underneath the umbrella anyway. You can back onto that as a country without actually having to hand over huge amounts of cash. Would you get more of a say if you were to join in with it? You probably would, but it would cost you an arm and a leg, and I suspect your armed forces would probably wish to see the money spent elsewhere.
Well, I'm talking more in terms of foreign relations. Assuming for a moment, and there is some intelligence to indicate that China is using North Korea as a client in this, China is making a large opening into Canada, particularly in trade. Canada is no longer just a middle power. Canada becomes an important power simply by the action of saying, all right, if North Korea is doing this, we're hooking up with the States, and we're going to be watching what kind of economic dealings are being done with China if they're posing even a distant threat to us. Would that not send a strong message if the Chinese have any influence with the North Koreans?
It certainly would send a message. How strong it is, I mean, you know, I can't, and even you, I suspect, couldn't judge it at this stage. But, you know, sending a message is all very well, but it has to be understood, and the right sort of message is understood when it hits the recipient.
Now, the frontline state, if we could call it that, it's really Japan, which doesn't have a large military, of course, since the end of the war. They were demilitarized. What are their defenses like, and what are their concerns? Or are they under the American
much
umbrella?
More important, probably, is that the U.S. have bases on Okinawa.
Yes.
Like that. I mean, hey, you know, if you're going to attack Japan by inclination, you also attack the United States, because if you're going to drop a nuclear missile on Japan, guaranteed, one of the U.S.
You can't say I meant to hit Osaka, so I'm sorry for the radiation in Okinawa that's killing 100,000 soldiers.
That isn't going to wash.
Even with all of Kim Jong-il's, false charms, but even those aren't there anymore.
No, I'm sorry. They got lost somewhere along the way.
What's the British position on this?
Very quiet. And I have to say, I read the Washington Post very early this morning in preparation for this show, and I found four lines on the Korea situation in the Washington Post, and it was a jokey type sort of article. Even the Washington Post isn't taking it too seriously today. I do know, as I mentioned before, Envoy Hill is currently doing a tour to gather the requisite amount of support. One of the problems is, obviously, if and you will understand that the inspections haven't been taking place of the atomic facilities and things like that, if we suspect that they do have nuclear weapons, is it was one of the premises of this current U.S. administration that, you know, there shouldn't be any more countries that have nuclear capabilities. Well, in this case, it's probably too late. And you can't actually stop them developing that at the moment. That's one of the fundamental challenges I think we're wrestling with, another country which has nuclear technology and the capability to deliver it.
And the possibility that a bunch of failed states could start whacking each other and drawing bigger powers into it.
Absolutely.
Colonel Peter Reynolds, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, Barrow.
Have a good time in Washington.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Joe, we'll be right back after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
I started out this show by commenting on Prime Minister Harper's vision for this country, that he may very well be the first prime minister since Laurier to give us an international notion of our responsibilities. I don't know about some of you, but it's been a long time since I got goosebumps listening to a Canadian politician. When he said that Canada doesn't cut and run anymore, and when he called for the arrest of the Iranian torturer, Azara Kazemi, the Montreal Four journalist killed in Tehran, was sent by Iran as an observer to the Human Rights Council, he showed a courage we haven't seen in Canada in many years. And above all, he has recognized and is moving Canada forward to a re-engagement with our traditional allies and a re-engagement in our proper role for the expansion of liberty in the world and for democratic development. And for that, you need a bigger military. And he's taken the hard decisions. He's made the calls for acquisition of more materiel, raising troop levels. And some in the opposition, as is Canada's wont, our political opposition, Her Majesty's loyal opposition, as it's called, usually opposes, rarely proposes. And some really silly things have been said by some of the political opponents in the Liberal Party and in the Bloc Québécois. And our next guest is one of the most authoritative voices on military and strategic affairs in the country. Reserve Colonel Rémi Landry is also a member of the Groupe d'études et de recherche en sécurité internationale de l'Université de Montréal. The acronym is JERSEY. And he's written a scathing attack on some of these politicians, but also on the Canadian smug mindset. And he points out their hypocrisies, calling them an insulte à l'intelligence, an insult to our intelligence. Et en dénonçant l'acquisition de nouveaux équipements, l'opposition a voulu se faire de capital politique au détriment des hommes et des femmes des forces armées canadiennes. In denouncing the acquisition of new equipment, opposition politicians are making political capital on the backs of the best of our youth, the men and women in the forces. And it's our pleasure to have Reserve Colonel Rémi Landry with us today. Good morning, Rémi.
Good morning, Mr. Wiseman.
No, Mr. Beryl's enough.
Good morning, Beryl. I'm not such an expert. I'm just a normal analyst of what's going on within the field of defense.
False modesty doesn't suit anybody. Remember what Churchill said. I may be a shameless self-promoter, but nobody can do it as well. You really got ticked off, particularly at Denis Coderre, and rightly so, because in the same week that Senator Colin Kenney, who's chair of the National Security and Defense Committee, was applauding this, Coderre was denouncing it, and as you rightly pointed out, it was his own government that was years late in doing these very same things and kept promising and promising and not fulfilling the promise.
Exactly. You have to realize that usually I do not get involved at that level. But what, in a way, troubled me is the way that Coderre attacked the actual government, just providing false information so that the public, I mean, more or less, never know exactly what's going on within the defense. And we always think that whatever the government buys for that is taking away from other programs. And the way that he more or less built his argument, I mean, make me really, really ashamed of what he represents, because not too long ago, and that's what I was trying to explain in my article, in November 2005, the former Minister of Defense was on the verge of announcing a program to change the Hercules. And within what filtered from his proposal was that, in fact, he was going to make the proposal in such a way that he was going to prefer Lockheed, because the fact is that we already have new Hercules that dates the mid-90s that we want to keep, and naturally, if you want to expand your fleet, you don't want to have two or three type of aircraft, which would require a different type of panoply of equipment, the logistic, and the training. So he did make at that time his project so that it would eventually benefit Lockheed. And now to hear Mr. Coderre saying that that's what the conservatives were doing, well, to me is a lack of responsibility
and open hypocrisy and political opportunism.
Just to make up some political advantage for his own person. And to voice, I don't know exactly what, because my point of view is very simple. Sure, I'm a former military.
Rémi, please, I'm sorry for interrupting you. We've got to pay some bills. Please stay with us, and we'll get back to you on your comments about Mr. Bachand from the Bloc as well. Montreal will be right back after this with Rémi Landry.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call the Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back. You can email me at info@iapm.ca. And we're talking to Reserve Colonel Remy Landry, who's a member of the Groupe d'études et des chefs de sécurité internationale at Université de Montréal, concerning the hypocrisy of opposition members' comments about our new military purchases. Remy, we talked about the Liberal position. What's Claude Bachon, the Blociste member, who's on the Defense Committee, what's his problem?
I don't really know, to be honest. I mean, it's not the first time that I do have words with Mr. Bachon. I've met him on numerous occasions, and most of the time when I've met him was during a change of command within the Quebec area. And him, too, realized that there's a kind of a paradox within the government concerning the forces. Either we decide not to have a forces and then eventually reduce to the bare limit, or either we decide to be more active and then we make sure that the people have what it takes to do the job. And as you just heard, I mean, we lost another Canadian.
Yes.
This morning, and it's the Liberal, okay? I'm not trying here to point the finger saying that it was wrong, but I think that we, the Liberal, realize that we need to do our share in this.
That's what, you know, that's what struck me when I read your paper, that Bill Graham, when he was defense minister, was saying how, yes, it's time, we don't have the right trucks, or we don't have the right helicopters, we don't have the right this, we don't have the right that. He made all these promises. All of a sudden, he's opposition leader, and everything has to be looked at again. How can they not feel any shame at this transparent hypocrisy?
And in addition to that, I mean, it's blur the public opinion, because then the people on the street just wonder, I mean, do we need to have this new equipment or do we need not? And that's what really make me furious when I hear those people.
And yet how many times have we seen the helicopters fall out of the sky, young men hurt and killed here in exercises? How many times have Canadian troops have to be transported by leased planes from other countries?
And the funny thing is that right now we probably are renting or borrowing helicopter from the Netherlands, which we used to have in the early 90s, because we had a fleet of about six Chinook that we sold for almost nothing to the Netherlands, and now those aircraft are still servicing in Afghanistan. And at the time, I'm sure that we are asking for those helicopters.
What makes me so angry and what maddens me so much about this country is that we think that it's due to us. Oh, we don't need anything because we have the Americans next door. But we can bring in anything we want. Cheap labor, cheap resources from any country under oppression. We have no responsibility to participate with anybody in giving hope to those people. We take comfort in the fact that in the Iraq operation, 39 out of 50 countries agreed to go with America. We're taking comfort that we were one of the 11 that didn't. It's a mindset that is boggling in its smug, unwarranted self-satisfaction. Doesn't this drive you crazy?
In addition to that, so that you are aware, I mean, as you know,
are we such a selfish people?
We're directly involved with Iraq right now, huh? And we are too.
Yes, and we have been through Operation Apollo. We were Central Command and Control, but neither Krechen nor Martin would recognize it until I think you know this fellow. He's certainly a friend of mine. Commander Richard Gimblett wrote the book on Operation Apollo, and two prime ministers would not recognize the largest Canadian military effort since Korea. It's staggering.
And in addition to that, throughout the Iraq war, at least the first few years, we had an average of about between 20 and 30 officers and senior NCM that were serving with the U.S. troops.
And the communication ships in the Gulf.
Exactly. So in a way, I mean, sure, I mean, you can be, as I've been saying throughout, you can be for or against the forces. I have no problem with people having their opinion on it. But what really, in a way, insults my intelligence is that on one end we say that we need them to be deployed and to do whatever we want them to do on the international scene, as the same thing within our national boundary to protect and to promote,
yes,
our sovereignty. And on the other hand, we seem to say that, well, they don't really need it. And to use an old expression of one of our prime minister, I mean, we don't really need to buy toys for the general. And I used to say to him, well, sir, we are not buying toys for the general. We are buying equipment.
And we're buying, buying protection.
The Canadian Forces is a national institution. It's not...
Not just an institution for the sake of an institution, but it helps Canadians. During
exactly.
the ice storm, it was the forces that cleared Montreal out.
And
it wasn't anybody else, and now we could...
We flew the troops from west to here.
That's correct. We couldn't move them today.
The American did it. So, again, I mean, let's be coherent. And let's explain to the people that, well, we need to pay our due on the international scene. We need to have a capability to be able to do our thing here at home, and here's the cost. And yet, that doesn't mean that we will have the best equipment, no, but just the bare bone of what it takes to do the job. And like I've written, the equipment that we are buying right now is just a skeleton, okay? Without this, you cannot have an army. And I've been saying to people, wait, the true buying, okay, the muscle that the government, the sectoral government will put on the skeleton, announcement yet to come. And according to the last report of the Senatorial Committee, there's maybe another $15 to $20 billion. And now that will be time for all the elite and all the politicians to say to the government, are we going in the right direction or not? But not for the time being.
Well, let's hope that with intelligent words like yours, we will be able to support the vision of this Prime Minister and restore Canada to the level of dignity we should have in the world. Remy Landry, thanks very much for taking the time of being with
us.
Montreal, we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Well, we've tried to give you an overall global view today. It's not just about the World Cup of Soccer, but the world. And as you're watching the games, remember that there are people who are suffering, that there are people who are living under oppression. There are people who can't afford a television set. Some of them can't afford a meal. But let's address this worldwide mania that's at least managed to bring together, by some accounts, 2 billion people today in one peaceful endeavor. The latest issue of Barricades, which is the journal of the Institute for Public Affairs, that I'm president of, is hitting the stands this week. And one article in it is called How Soccer Might Save the World, by our good friend and collaborator, Anthony Philbin, who's president of Philbin Communications, and he joins us right now. Tony, welcome.
Hi, Beryl. How are you?
I'm well. All right. You're going to take me down a notch now because you're going to take away some of my anger, so I'll be good. I'll behave. Now, Tony Philbin wrote, by taking our aggressive tribal need for competitive differentiation and accommodating it to non-military and economically non-disruptive athletic forms, sport has proven itself the great facilitator of civilization. In this article entitled How Soccer Might Save the World. Okay, let's say you're right. We'll all go into Roman Colosseums and stadiums. But how long and when?
Oh, I think it's a long time from now, obviously. There's still too much self-interest involved in how the world works, and soccer saving the world is about really the world developing a new consciousness and a really truly global consciousness. That's still down the road somewhere. But the point of the article is that we're going to need something to assuage our need for competitive differentiation along that road. And I think soccer is the best athletic event that we have right now to bring the world together in that way and to let nations still feel like they're different, even as they're bureaucratically, through immigration, economically becoming more and more integrated.
And you quote UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who says, the World Cup is an event in which we see goals being reached. I'm not talking only about goals a country scores. I also mean the most important goal of all, being there, part of the family of nations and peoples, celebrating our common humanity.
Yeah, I think the UN goes through a phase of soccer envy every time the World Cup comes around, frankly. It does for the world, something that the UN struggles to do and strives to do and often has a great deal of difficulty doing, which is creating that single unified event that the world can really rally around. And even as we remain different, even as we remain apart in ourselves as Canadians, Americans, Mexicans, whatever, French and Italians especially over today, at the same time, it brings everybody together in a peaceful way. And I think that's what the UN and that's what all of us need to struggle to find are more forms, more events that can do that for us.
You're in communication. You've been a communication specialist for many years, and you have experience with sports agencies. You do work for the World Anti-Doping Agency. What do you have to say about some of the main commercial that's been broadcast throughout North America on the World Cup, the part that says, it focuses in on a stadium, and it says, this is our cathedral, and it focuses on a player genuflecting, saying, and this is our religion. Is that a universal theme, or is that some particular parochial particularity?
Well, that's a particular parochial particularity. That's an advertiser trying to use the World Cup to say that it has as much importance to some people now as religion. Probably it does, probably even more. I think you'll see more people glued to their television sets today than you'll see behind any pulpits anywhere in the world. In that sense, soccer has transcended religion in a way. It's provided a unifying single event, the forum that people can get together in, that can surround themselves in and feel like they're part of something bigger. Religion tries to do that. Many religions are failing to do that these days. But
I'm not sure, though, that you would have done that commercial that way. I think you might have done it better.
I hope I would have done it better.
Tony, if you would bear with us, we got a friend of ours calling in, and I know you know this gentleman. Albert's Billy is president of the Canadian Corporate Soccer League, so now you and him can beat up on me over my less than enthusiastic support for diversion and entertainment of people. Albert's Billy, welcome.
Hi, Bill.
So you've heard Tony Philbin, and I presume you agree with him that this might save, if soccer won't save the world, as president of the Canadian Corporate Soccer League, you at least think it'll make our lives better. Why?
Well, I think soccer will definitely save the world. I mean, if you think about it, it's the only international
Tony, language you got to vote.
It's the only international language we have. I mean,
okay, Albert, wait a minute. Yeah, I love it. You know, we're going to go on with you guys for a while, but I mean, you. It's an incredible thing. So after millennium of crawling out of the jungles, mankind has achieved the level where the only thing that is the common language are a bunch of men running around the field kicking around the ball. So there's no hope for any seriousness of mind or purpose.
Well,
that is now the commonality of human being. You know, guys are always going to make me so depressed, I'm just going to leave.
Well, people don't care about bureaucrats, Beryl. People care about the team. how it works.
But I mean, that's it, Albert. Is that it? I mean, we can't, this is the height, the zenith of human accomplishment.
Well, if you think about it,
our producer Val Prudnikoff is going number one. So you got another fan. I got 3-1 against me. I don't care.
If you think about it, I mean, the game is open to men and women around the world. They play it with a set rules. I mean, if you think about it, the rules are United Nations, and every single nation, every single country, every single territory on the face of the earth actually has a seat on FIFA. And so everyone plays.
Hold that thought, Albert. I'm going to get back to that for a second and show you how all these international organizations are really screwing up the ability of human beings to be human and decent. We'll be right back with Tony Philbin and Albert's Billy right after this.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal. This is the new 940 Montreal. Let's talk. Call the Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, at 790-0006.
Montreal, we're back and we're talking to Tony Philbin, president of Philbin Communications, about how soccer might save the world, and Albert's Billy, president of the Canadian Corporate Soccer League. And Albert was just telling me how FIFA is an international organization. Brings together people under one common set of rules. So let me ask you, Albert, how great is FIFA that in the last Olympics, when the Iraqis didn't do well, Uday Hussein, Saddam's son, tortured 3 Iraqi athletes in the Olympic Village. FIFA said nothing. FIFA says nothing about, you know, soccer fields being used by Palestinians to launch rockets against Israel, but had a big objection when one Israeli rocket hurt one of the soccer fields in Palestine. So what is FIFA the apex of morality?
Well, I think, Beryl, I'm not going to defend the actions of FIFA or the...
Oh, by the way, the reason FIFA did nothing about Uday Hussein's torturing of those three Iraqi soccer players is because the president of FIFA, who's still the same president today, said that they're non-political.
Well, they are non-political, but I mean, I think that, you know, no organization is perfect, but the key here is that FIFA has established a sort of set rules that no matter where you go on the face of the earth, you can play soccer the same way that everyone else plays. If you're in Vancouver, just like you are in Baghdad, you'll be playing soccer the same way. And so with that principle, basically is saying that we all understand this game. Every single human on the face of the earth understands this game. This afternoon, there will be over a billion people on the face of the earth who will be watching one game. So I mean,
and Tony Philbin, that means what to you?
As a
litmus test of mankind going forward.
Well, FIFA isn't there to supplant the United Nations or to develop bureaucratic standards. It's not there to do with any of those things. It's simply there to do what Albert said, which is to establish the rules of a game that can be played everywhere in the world. And why soccer is going to save the world is not because FIFA is going to develop new bureaucracies to help us out. It's because it's going to give us the chance to let people still feel different from one another, even as we become more and more the same, even as the UN develops those bureaucratic standards or other bodies eventually over time. That's what the role of soccer is. It's the game itself. It's not FIFA. It's not a group of individuals. It's simply the ability of the game to let people differentiate themselves even as they come together.
And neither of you are worried about the fact that people just may feel that since they think they can't affect the real problems in our world, the real political and distributive problems, they just turn to this as divertissement?
No, soccer is not something to supplant those efforts. Soccer is something to assist with those efforts. Because the more people can come together through soccer, through games like soccer, the more people are going to be able to cooperate more effectively together in other areas. That's the role of soccer.
Just remember one thing. I mean, Beryl, the Israeli national soccer team has four Palestinian Arabs who play on that team. And during the last qualifying round, it's these four Palestinian Arabs who scored the goals and who actually made Israel advance to a point where they were on the verge of getting a berth into this World Cup.
Well, just good. I don't mean to cut you off, but we're fighting time. I hope that'll someday mean that Jews can get visas to Arab countries other than Jordan and Egypt. But I would like to be wrong on this one. Tony Philbin, Albert's Billy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Beryl.
Montreal, enjoy the afternoon. We're going into the pre-game show, which will last till 3 o'clock, and then the World Cup final, France and Italy. Enjoy yourselves today, but remember this thought, that there will be responsibilities tomorrow, and that you can make a difference. You don't have to sublimate your anger and your rage. You don't have to worry about just entertaining yourselves because you think you have no power. Because each time you stand up for an ideal, each time you act to improve the lot of others or yourself, each time you strike out against injustice, you send forth a tiny ripple of hope. And crossing each other from those thousands of different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that will sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. And those words were said by Robert Kennedy in 1966 in the Soweto ghetto in South Africa, when dispossessed and disenfranchised, blacks did nothing more and could do nothing more with their lives than what the state allowed them in their ghettos. And yet words were spoken that the Stephen Bikos and the other leaders came forward and had the courage to turn a society from a nation of sheep that stopped finally electing a government of wolves. Montreal, enjoy your afternoon. We thank Nick Mays, our operator, Val Prudnikov, our producer. Until next time.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal.